This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Duke Ellington, Fletcher Henderson, Benny Goodman, Jimmy and Tommy Dorsey, among the artists of the big band era. The era has been called a musical golden age, but by and large the music has been criticized in recent years as escapist and as a commercial exploitation of African-American music. Historian Lewis Ehrenberg says it's time big jazz bands got some respect, a closer look. In his new book, Swingin' the Dream, Ehrenberg writes, swing music mirrored a new optimism about democratic culture, an appreciation of ethnic and racial pluralism, and a delight in the utopian promise of urban life. He continues, for a variety of fans in the 1930s and 1940s, dreams of new sexual relationships and new American identities came together in the throes of the jitterbug dance. Lewis Ehrenberg is our guest today on the Afternoon Magazine. As we talk, I hope you'll join the discussion in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. Anywhere else, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Lewis Ehrenberg is a professor of history at Loyola University. He's the author of the new book, Swingin' the Dream, Big Band Jazz and the Rebirth of American Culture. The book is published by the University of Chicago Press. Toll-free 1-800-222-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Professor Ehrenberg, good afternoon. Welcome.
Glad to be here.
In my introduction, I mentioned that the music of the era has been dismissed by a good number of folks as escapist and commercial exploitation of black American artists and music. Are those charges without any merit?
There's definitely some merit to those charges. This was the most commercially popular period for jazz, I think, in its history. So, indeed, it's commercial, and where you have commerce, you have a number of companies, a number of businesses, a number of entrepreneurs in the music industry that sought to benefit from it economically. So, yes, there's also the charge that this period was the whitest period in popular music. The white band leaders, such as Benny Goodman or Tommy, Jimmy Dorsey, whom you mentioned, Glenn Miller, most notably, and a host of others, really benefited the most from the music. They appropriated the art forms of African Americans. Yes, there's something to that. But what I at least struggled with was that there seemed to be something else going on as well, and that this period really involved a struggle over the terms of what an American musical culture would be at the popular level. For example, okay, let's one event that struck me immediately occurred in 1938, and that was the Benny Goodman concert, swing concert at Carnegie Hall. Now, here's a largely white band led by Benny Goodman, who had come from Chicago, was a member of the Chicago jazz scene of the 1920s. He has a big band. He plays arrangements by African-American musicians and arrangers, such as Fletcher Henderson or Jimmy Monday and others. And if it were just appropriation, I think the concert would have been like Paul Whiteman's concert in 1924, where the white bands played, and that was it. But what happened? First of all, Goodman featured his trio and then quartet, which included African-American musicians, playing on an equal level with white musicians. And those musicians, like Teddy Wilson in the trio, the very famous pianist, and Lionel Hampton, the vibraphonist, became stars in their own right to some extent as because of their association with Goodman. Now, that the issue of race doesn't stop there at the concert, because in addition, Goodman invited members of Duke Ellington's orchestra. Ellington himself declined to participate, but members of Ellington's orchestra played on stage as well with members of Goodman's orchestra. And to top that all off, there was a jazz session between a number of Goodman's musicians and members of the Count Basie band. So for the King of Swing, anyway, at this particular moment, one of the peak events, I think, of the swing era, there was a different vision of what America could be. And it included, at least as far as this event is concerned, African Americans. And I think that led me to see some of what was going on as a harbinger of the future and some of the positive aspects of the future in terms of breaking down the barriers of segregation, rather than just a replication of white supremacy, which does exist as well in the swing era.
Mm. There was a coming together of musical styles, jazz and symphonic music. And I guess one of the things I'd like you to talk about here is how these musicians found one another, came together, and played the way they did together.
Well, I'm not exactly sure what you mean, how they found each other, but let me interpret that in a certain way, and then
okay.
You can jump in, you know, if I don't get anywhere near the question. First of all, a lot of the, let's say, the white band leaders had taken up jazz in the 20s and had attended black clubs, black dance halls. They were familiar with African-American musicians. Many of them in their youth idolized African-American musicians, especially someone like Louis Armstrong, for example,
mm-hmm.
who had an enormous effect not just on black musicians, but also on white musicians.
Mm-hmm.
And what also happens in the early 30s is that the Depression really wipes out a number of jazz scenes, a number of lucrative places to play. And a lot of musicians, starting in the late 20s and early 30s, have congregated in New York City because radio really is very strong in New York. The recording industry is strong in New York. It's where they think they can work. And they come together in the clubs of Harlem initially because the white musicians really are somewhat disgusted by having to play radio music. They don't get a chance to play jazz,
mm-hmm.
so they're looking to where that jazz is being played. That's initially in Harlem and then later on 52nd Street, which is in Midtown Manhattan. Now, a lot of the contacts that they make early on in the early 30s are played out in the later part of the decade and in the early 40s. They know a lot of folks. They jam with a lot of folks. They're not reluctant, for example, to, you know, hang out with African Americans. Now, it's also true that the exchange that occurs between blacks and whites in the musical world is unequal because white musicians, again, a Goodman, an Artie Shaw, the Dorseys, whomever, they can take that music and play anywhere, whereas the black musicians, not just starting in the 30s, but going back earlier, are restricted in where they can play. They get something from, you know, playing with Benny Goodman. They get something from jamming, I mean, with white musicians. They, in New York, are very much invested in a repertoire that includes Tin Pan Alley tunes, the standards that we associate with Cole Porter or the Gershwins, but still they can't play that music as much in quote-unquote white venues. And that, and especially they can't play regularly on the radio. And it's the radio and who can get on radio, I think, that really determines the fact that the whites come to the fore. For example, by 1934, Fletcher Henderson, who had helped create the synthesis of the big band sound, who, with his arranger in the 1920s, Don Redman, found a way to make a big band swing, so to speak, to have
mm-hmm.
the sections and the soloists work together to provide a sense of momentum and exchange and interaction. He's bankrupt. The Depression really had limited where he could play. He could have used a regular radio show where a sponsor and an advertising agency came together and publicized his name, his accomplishments. He could be heard over the air on a regular basis. If that had occurred, he could have gotten a variety of one-night engagements throughout the country. Well, no African-American musician could get a nationally sponsored program for a long period of time. Once in a while it happened, but very short-term, usually local, because the sponsors worried that if their product was associated with African-Americans, it would lower the tone of their product. So, who gets to go on radio? Benny Goodman. I mean, he can go, or Tommy Dorsey initially can go on radio where Fletcher Henderson can't. And that's what I mean by the unequal exchange.
Yeah. They're playing Fletcher Henderson arrangements.
Oh, they're absolutely playing Fletcher Henderson arrangements. And what's interesting, again, to me, is that Goodman could have denied, you know, that Henderson had anything to do with his success. One of the things about Goodman, the positive things about Goodman, and there are a number of negative things in my mind, but one of the positive things about Goodman is that he always acknowledged that it was Fletcher Henderson who created the arrangements. He never claimed that he was, you know, the almighty American individual who had pulled himself up creatively, you know, by his own bootstraps. He always acknowledged Fletcher Henderson until the end of his life. Moreover, what he does is buy arrangements from Fletcher Henderson. Henderson gets a certain amount of money in 1934, and in about a year, year and a half, he's back fronting his own band. So in other words, it wasn't the greatest arrangement, one, you know, top musician selling arrangements to another. I mean, I don't recommend it, and I think it hurt Henderson in the long run. On the other hand, he was bankrupt, and getting the money for the arrangements, getting more exposure at a critical time, allowed him to try to go out in the band business again. Well, he has some hits. About 1936, there's a song called Christopher Columbus that I think Henderson writes, and it, you know, it's played on jukeboxes, it crosses over a bit. But he never really can sustain himself as a band leader in the late 30s. In part, it's because of his own personal manner. His musicians don't entirely respect him for a variety of reasons. But the point I'm making is that by 1939, when he's not making it as a band leader, Goodman hires him again as an arranger, but also as the first African-American pianist, not in the trio, not in a quartet, but in the big band. So Goodman, I think, maintains a relationship with Henderson over a long period of time. And then in the early 40s, Henderson, and I don't know the motivation behind this, but Henderson writes in one of the music magazines that in order to continue what Benny Goodman had done by hiring some African-American musicians, he, Henderson, was now hiring white musicians for a largely African-American band. So something is going on there between the two of them that is, at least in my mind, not entirely negative and not entirely appropriation, although the advantage clearly is with Goodman.
Yeah. Also, you know, there's this kind of mixed picture all through the story here.
Yes.
I mean, when we see Billie Holiday singing with Artie Shaw in a hotel ballroom, she can't stay in that hotel.
Absolutely.
And she has to ride up in the back elevator.
Absolutely. And that happens in the north at the Lincoln Hotel in New York City, and it produces some of the most sarcastic statements that Billie Holiday or her ghostwriter, depending on who wrote the autobiography, had to say about the swing era. On the other hand, here's Artie Shaw, who's struggling with his band. It's almost the kiss of death to have a mixed, a racially mixed band. And then you add in the sexual connotations I mean, it's a male band with a female singer. And, you know, Billie Holiday was a good-looking woman. She conveyed a sense of sensuality, certainly, you know, when she got up there to sing. And that must have invited all sorts of hostility from white audiences in the border states and in the Upper South where the band toured. And yet, Shaw, you know, continued to lead the band through that area, and members of the band would get into fights with sheriffs. They would get into fights with hostile whites, prejudiced whites, who made no bones about the fact that they didn't like the fact that Billie Holiday, you know, was singing with a white band. What the problem when they came to New York was that Shaw found that his band agency, the hotel management, the radio network people ganged up on him basically to threaten the viability of the band on radio at this critical moment for the band if they didn't limit Billie Holiday's role. And they fought it for a while, but they couldn't keep fighting it and survive as a band. And Shaw felt that he had been forced to compromise on something of importance. He was not happy with himself for having done it. And several years later, he's back attempting to travel with Roy Eldridge and Willie Smith, other African-American musicians. So he doesn't give up. Also, in terms of Billie Holiday, Billie Holiday must have had some of the worst experiences of the swing era.
Mm-hmm.
I'm laughing not at her, but just at, you know, just the things that she went through. It's amazing when you think about it that the bands, as a number of musicians wrote, were the first freedom riders. Now, I think that's overdone.
Yeah.
And you could look at black bands who traveled in the South putting up with all sorts of stuff, from Cab Calloway to the Basie Band to Ellington. But when bands, whether mixed bands or all black bands, traveled in particular areas, especially the South or the border states, but not exclusively as we can talk, they just faced all sorts of hassles that were attempted to undermine their humanity. From, like, the basic issue with Billie Holiday, she couldn't use a bathroom. Where is she going to go when, first of all, there are no bathrooms for long stretches as they're riding on the bus? They get to a gas station, and it's, men, women, colored. She felt demeaned by that. Often she basically had to hold it in the vernacular for long stretches of time. She ended up with a urinary tract infection. She was very upset about the whole thing. Or African-American musicians describe having to hit the bushes. So they're facing, you know, that kind of the heart of the system of segregation, which says that African Americans are less than whites, that the white supremacy is the law of the land, at least in the South, and their very presence challenges it in particular ways. When they play a dance, whether it's a mixed band, and that was rarer, or an all-black band, often you've got white Southerners who like the music. And it creates certain disjunctures between their racial beliefs and their musical likes.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is very important. They get into a lot of trouble. The police often are very firm in trying to enforce white supremacy. There are a number of incidences where the kind of male musicians are baited by white females, and this creates all sorts of, you know, physical problems, that is, fights, etc. But still, their very presence raises a challenge to the notion of white supremacy, which I think probably causes so much of the violence. Because here they, I mean, just imagine Duke Ellington playing some of the venues in the South. Here is this elegant African-American aristocrat, definitely by now a northerner, or associate as a northerner, who is playing this incredible music. It's so rich harmonically, it's almost symphonic.
Mm-hmm.
His musicians are well-dressed. They're playing from behind music stands. They're in tuxedos or evening attire. And Ellington was a handsome man, and many of the musicians were handsome. And I'm sure that various kinds of sexual feelings, crossed that boundary on the part of members of the audience, especially female members. Well, this raises certain questions about the meaning of white supremacy. And it's also why the police would try to keep blacks and whites apart at dance halls, in theaters, where these black bands were playing.
You talk about an event in Chicago that I find really interesting. In August of 1938 at Soldier Field, a racially mixed audience for a free swing jamboree. Talk with us about this event. This is very different than a Duke Ellington concert.
Oh, yeah. Well, this, I'm glad you asked. there are a number of these vignettes that really stood out as I was doing the research. And this was one, in part because I live in Chicago.
Yeah.
In the summer of 1938, the New Century Committee, a mayoral committee, decided to put on a free swing jamboree, in part because a lot of the fans of the music couldn't afford the money that it would take to go to a ballroom or to go to one of the theaters or whatever. This is a chance to see a number of the top bands live. And Earl Hines, for example, was scheduled to play. Jimmy Dorsey was scheduled to play. There were going to be amateur band contests. There would be amateur dance contests. And it was a big event, and it was held at Soldier's Field. Well, the night of the concert, 100,000 people poured inside. And another 70,000 to 100,000, depending on which estimate one reads, waited outside to get in. And they couldn't wait, and they cracked the gates or broke through the gates, stampeded onto the field. People came down from the stands. And, you know, the microphone lines, because it was supposed to be broadcast, were disrupted. The concert had to be stopped for a while so order could be restored. So the professional bands are off the bandstand and the dance stands that were set up. And what you find are all these kids, some black, some white, are parading through Soldier Field, playing their own instruments, singing their own songs, dancing, in response to what people are singing and playing. And it was like this spontaneous crowd reaction that I see as part of the swing era. You know, you started with the question about, is it commercialized or mm-hmm. is it commercial exploitation? And of course, somebody is making a lot of money off this. On the other hand, here are all these kids who are crashing the gates that were set up to keep them out because they definitely want to hear this music. Here is this spontaneous crowd reaction which says, not only is it commercial exploitation, but there's a real market here. This means something to a huge generation that came of age in the 1930s. They want to hear it. They think it's their music. And then, of course, you get all this speculation in the Chicago Tribune, the Chicago Daily Times, whatever the other newspapers are. What does this mean?
Right.
And psychologists then as now write in that it represents this or that or, some deep-seated problem among youth and the dissettled, unsettled quality of American culture and the depression. It goes on and on and on. And it's sexually stimulating and orgiastic this and all sorts of stuff comes out. However, what's interesting to me is that this crowd activity is not the only thing. I see a lot of spontaneous activity on the part of crowds. They want to take part. They want to participate. This is a mass phenomenon mm-hmm. symbolized by the crowd. That says something, I think, about young people in the Depression and about the culture of the 1930s as well.
Well, also, if you look at just going from a nightclub scene to a ballroom. This is a mass, you know, kind of event.
Yes.
And also, you know, from talking with my mom about these kinds of events, that this was a place, a time and a place where people from all kinds of economic and social class got together.
Especially in ballrooms. They are mass as opposed to the class of a nightclub. The cover charges in nightclubs are, you know, discourage a lot of folks from going.
Mm-hmm.
That's where a lot of jazz had been played in the 20s. By the 30s, it is the ballroom, the big dance hall. And it's not only a big dance hall, it is a big band that plays to a big dance hall. And I think that there's a working back and forth between the concerns on the bandstand and the concerns in the audience that gives the music and this phenomenon its special quality. What you've got is a sense of a mass population that has been unsettled, I think, by the Depression. What they want, and this is speculation to some extent, what they want is to hear that beat of life go on, and the bands supply it. They also are comfortable being part of a big crowd. It is, to some extent, the antithesis of what is called traditional American individualism, the cult of success. You stand out alone. On the crowd, lots of people are dancing, or that other kind of icon of the period, they're standing in huge rows, just watching the band and listening and looking at the musicians. On the bandstand, there are 14 to 16 musicians, and that increases during the war, up to 20 and 22, where the individual soloist is important but is not more important than the rest of the band. That individual has to fit into this larger musical product, this musical experience. And the individual soloist gains strength from having the power of the group behind him, in this case. Mm-hmm. And it's that sense, I think, of the group, the band of brothers, banding together, which I see as part of the pull of the big bands and part of the meaning of that experience.
Isn't it interesting, then, that this, after the Second World War, and as we head into the late 40s and early 50s, that all this kind of fades away, but then it will return with sock hops and rock and roll and rock concerts.
It does return, and there's a generational shift. The big beat is what it's called when rock and roll comes back. And it's different music, obviously,
right.
but there is a mass phenomenon that returns.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something about that big beat. Well, one, it makes it easy to dance to if you can hear the beat.
Mr. Clark, I'd rate that a number 10 because
right.
It's easy to dance to.
Right. Yeah, it's got a good beat, and you can dance to it. I grew up on American Bandstand and also on Alan Freed and some of the rhythm and blues shows. But what happens before rock and roll is that after World War II, this whole musical scene fragments for a variety of reasons. And the push and the power of this kind of big band synthesis really begins to lose its energy. What are the parts of the what are the pieces that fragment? Well, first of all, the big swing bands, black or white, just find it difficult to gain audiences after World War II. The bands that continue are usually the melodic bands, or as they're often called, sweet bands. There's a number of reasons people give for this. One has to do with mating, courting,
mm-hmm.
the desire for people who've been apart because of World War II to get married, settle down, and the sweet music really expressed that sense of desire for monogamy. This is a speculation. It has some merit, I think. The other thing is that coming out of the big swing bands, a number of young black musicians were caught in the the tension between the hopes of swing, some measure of opportunities for, or equal measure of opportunities for African Americans, African American musicians, some sense that life was improving as a result of the New Deal, some sense that the future could be seen as positive. But also, while young African American musicians see some desegregation of the big bands, what they realize is that for all black bands, it's still hard to make it. It's still hard for the Earl Hines band, or the Count Basie band, or Jimmy Lunsford band, or the Billy Eckstein band, I was reaching for that one, to get regular bookings. And so they're reacting to some extent to the notion that, well, sure, there's some integration going on, but as black bands, as entities within the black community, we're still shut out. This results to some extent in a musical insurgency around bebop, which is self-consciously modern. It's outspoken in racial terms. It's incredible music, but it's also not danceable. What picks up the danceable slack? Another kind of line or fragment out of the big bands, rhythm and blues. This is what's getting revived of late in what's called the neo-swing revival. Louis Jordan, who had been a saxophonist with the Chick Webb Orchestra, sees that the big bands are becoming more modern, that bop is one way to go, and he really likes entertainment. He doesn't want to be just a virtuoso musician such as a Dizzy Gillespie or a Charlie Parker. He wants to connect with the audience, and he's kind of picking up the tempo on an older blues style, giving it a new rhythm, and it's becoming rhythm and blues. And the mass black audience really goes in that direction, leaving a number of boppers, for example, mm-hmm. very upset about the future of their music. And while they can gain something of an audience, the audience really hits a kind of boundary beyond which it can't go. It can't become mass or popular as swing had become. The other line out of the big bands, I think, has to do with the vocalists. And this many people have talked about.
Yeah.
You know, the band era to the vocalist era, with Frank Sinatra as the key linchpin.
Uh-huh.
Now, what I see there is what causes, there are a number of things having to do with the musicians' strike during the war, the big bands can't record, singers can because they're not unionized, and, you know, they gain a following. But I also think that it's somewhat deeper than that, in that the individual musician comes to stand out in a period when there's greater affluence, even though there's a war on, there's money to be spent, people can begin to think less of the overall group and more about their individual futures, their individual needs and desires and dreams. And I think the individual vocalist concretizes that in his or her person. And there are many more women singers who stand out in the late 40s. So instead of the bands being on radio, by 1947, it's the vocalists who have the shows, who have the sponsorship, mm-hmm. because they link up with audiences at a particular moment.
I want to reintroduce you, and then I want to go back to women and girls in the audience.
Oh, great.
And the jitterbug. Our guest this afternoon, Lewis Ehrenberg, he's a professor of history at Loyola. We're talking with him about his new book, Swingin' the Dream, Big Band Jazz and the Rebirth of American Culture. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Now, if we can go back to Soldier Field there for a mm-hmm. moment, 1938, and we've already mentioned kind of the sensuality and the sexuality and the beauty of Billie Holiday and how that's kind of dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Then also we've got this dance, the jitterbug, which is kind of suggestive.
Well, it, and, yeah.
And also, we've there's a wonderful comment that you have, a self-described jitterbug says, you can't expect, quote, a modern girl who drives a car, knows about planes and fast ships, to monkey around with minuets.
Yeah.
So this is a powerful, this is a lot of power, and women are, black and white, are part of this.
They're part of it, and I think the question is, what part do they
right.
play? Now, I have to say that it was more difficult to get the point of view of women for this project than I was able to do in another project, my first book, where the stuff around women in the teens and 20s, you know, their sense of freedom, the flapper, the new woman, women entertainers, was just in the forefront.
Right.
What I find in the 30s and 40s is that there's a tremendous emphasis on men. Most of the bands are men. The women singers, for example, are part of the band. They don't stand out. They're a secondary part. They're treated as kind of a necessary evil. In the dances, these are couple dances, the Lindy and the Jitterbug,
mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that it's a different emphasis on the couple and what women can do. There's greater freedom for women in the dance,
mm-hmm.
but the men are still leading in a particular way. I mean, there's the open hold is what characterizes the Lindy. That is, there's a distance, and usually the guys are twirling, you know, the girls around, and if they're very adventurous, you know, they can lift them up and fling
mm-hmm.
them about. Well, this emphasizes male strength. Well, what about the woman? There are times in the course of the dance where both people are improvising steps. And that's where women have the most freedom of movement in the dance. And yet, it's a fluid dance. It's somewhat, depending on who's doing it, it can be rough or it can be very smooth. But there's a certain sense of, within the couple arrangement, that women have the right to improvise as much as men, that they have a say as to what will happen, that their actions flow back and forth with the men.
The lead is still the male, but the woman can...
She can improvise
mm-hmm.
within this.
Mm-hmm.
And it, what you know, there's a room for a certain egalitarian sense that she has a lot of room for maneuver in the personal relationship that is the dance.
Mm-hmm.
Now, better than that, I'm not sure I can
yeah.
say it. But the other thing that I've noticed is that there's tremendous criticism initially of the Jitterbug. Well, why is that? Well, one, nothing ever changes, and whenever there's anything new, you're going to get criticism. But there's a sense that somehow, you know, this the music is orgiastic, and therefore the dancing is inherently sexual. Well, the defenders of the dance usually say, well, it's not that sexual compared to the stuff that was done in the early 30s where people were clinging to each other in kind of slow dances. There's no chance to really cling here. You know, you're too much of a distance. You're dancing too fast. This is not sexual at all. And to some extent, there's, I think, upon reflection after finishing,
mm-hmm.
you know, the book, that this generation is not entirely comfortable with sexuality. That this dance allows for a certain amount of watching the other person strut one's stuff, but you're not the couple is not, you know, grinding against each other
yeah.
In that explicit way that occurs in the slow dances. And so I think there's a certain reluctance to be fully sexual, because in the midst of the Depression, that can lead to all sorts of problems. Similarly, if, like the girl singer, as she's called, in the bands,
uh-huh.
You know, they sing songs mostly about love and romance. The sexual stuff is conveyed by the the way they're dressed and their attitude on stage. And clearly, there's some of that. But on the other hand, the singers really portray themselves often as, you know, good working girls. They're working to make a living. They have to fit into the all-male world. Often they portray themselves as mothers who take care of the rest of the band. They can't be too ladylike. Yeah. They can't be too dependent. They're, you know, they got to be one of the guys. And being one of the guys, as a public image, seems to me to undercut, to some extent, the sensuality that the female singer usually conveys. So I think that there's a certain hesitancy mm-hmm. about overt sexuality in this period.
Interesting. And I suppose that that would, without those kinds of things coming from the girl singer, that there would be people in the audience who might be uncomfortable.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're here almost. We're here at the end of our time. My time has gone so quickly. I do want to ask you though. What you've seen? There's an advertisement on television that features the Jitterbug selling khakis.
I haven't seen that.
Louis Prima.
Oh, Louis Prima
is playing.
Yeah.
And it's for a relatively happening retail chain. And, you know, I was wondering what you might make of that.
Well, since I haven't seen it, it's going to be pure speculation
yeah.
on my part, but hopefully educated.
Well,
I think that, advertisers are certainly aware uh-huh. of any currents, you know, that are popular. And there has been this neo-swing revival. Louis Prima goes right back to the 30s. He played 52nd Street. He had a kind of a voice that was somewhat like Louis Armstrong's. He was a dark-skinned Italian, so he fit that kind of in-between quality, a creolized quality that I see as part of swing in the 30s. So that was then. By playing this, they're appealing to people who somehow find that music appealing now, and there are people who do so. The movie Swingers, for example, used a lot of the music from that era, and they used new bands who are current today, younger bands, who somehow are either copying the music of the 30s and filling dance halls with dancers in Washington, D.C., I heard, New York at times. There's the swing revival. It started apparently in Los Angeles. In Chicago, there are clubs where you can take swing lessons, Lindy Hop lessons, and so on.
Really?
That's what I think they're appealing to. And some of the bands, in my view, are better than others. But that's what I think the ad is trying to pick up on. But also, wouldn't it be interesting, now, if in fact it's the Lindy Hop and the kids are jumping around, and they're very athletic, they're very energetic, it's mm-hmm. vital, it's vibrant, but they're at a distance, mm-hmm. and it's not overtly sexual. It'd be like the perfect dance to be recreated for the unfortunate age of AIDS.
Yeah, interesting.
But again, that's all speculation.
Yeah, well, I was just reading in the New York Times, there was a little blurb in this week about a club called the Red Blazer,
mm-hmm.
and they're doing a swing thing, apparently, and they are trying to jump ahead already. I guess next year is the 100th birth anniversary of Duke Ellington.
Oh, my.
And so they've already started to build into their weekly, you know, calendar an Ellington night.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what I see happening, and how far this will go, I don't know. But I do know the New York Times wrote recently about the neo-swing revival, and I suppose that makes it official, I don't know. But they predicted, the guy who wrote it, predicted about 6 years before the swing revival runs its course. I don't know how deep it is, but things are going on, and from my point of view, I would love to see a revival of big dance halls where people could actually go and dance. In response to the music, because for the most part, you know, to find a place to dance, you know, you're in crowded little clubs, and they're very smoky, and mm-hmm. for the most part, what I see are a bunch of people standing around in front of the band, and Well, I'm a dancer, and you know, I'm always discouraged by that.
Yeah. Well, let's open up those high school gyms.
Yeah. Socks.
Yeah.
They're coming back.
Thanks so much for talking with us this afternoon. It's really been a pleasure.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine. Thank you.
Louis Ehrenberg has been our guest. Look for his book, Swingin' the Dream, Big Band Jazz and the Rebirth of American Culture.